Before we get started, we are doing a little something different today. This is a pilot episode. We're going to answer this week's question in a long-form storytelling format. Thank you for listening. Let us know what you think. A fire spread across Chicago on October 8th, 1871. It burned for 36 hours. Then, rainfall mercifully put it out. The devastation was immense. The fire destroyed thousands of buildings, it killed 300 people, and it left 100,000 people homeless. In the smoldering ashes, there were stories of looting, chaos. So the mayor of Chicago declared martial law. Hundreds of federal troops were brought in to keep the peace.
They're literally marching in basically the day after the fire. And to be really clear, when they march in, a whole bunch of people in Chicago are literally standing on the streets, you know, applauding them for coming in and protecting the city.
Martial law lasted less than 2 weeks. 10 days in, a member of the federal force shot and killed a civilian, a Chicago city attorney named Thomas Grosvenor.
You know, within a couple days, this falls apart like a house of cards, and the federal soldiers are gone.
I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. In recent months, we've gotten a few questions about martial law. When federal immigration agents descended on Chicago and Minneapolis, one listener wanted to know, was that martial law? What does martial law even mean? Another listener wanted to know about the last time we had martial law in Chicago. It was after the Great Fire. In reading about it, they saw parallels between then and now. So today, we're going to talk with author Scott W. Berg, whose voice you just heard, about how martial law was implemented after the fire. But first, we're going to talk with a few historians and law professors about what martial law is. And do you know it when you see it? Curious City producer Justin Bull picks up the story right after the break.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering a roster of public events under the theme, No One Can Afford to Lose Love. All are welcome to readings by exceptional Chicago poets, like National Book Award winner Patricia Smith and Chicago Poet Laureate Maida Del Valle, a live musical performance by Decomposed, and more. Details at poetryfoundation.org.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
I'm producer Justin Bull. In September, the Trump administration launched an aggressive crackdown on illegal immigration in Chicago.
What's your name?
Debbie Brockman. I work for WGN. Let them know.
I got you.
Amid protests, hundreds of federal immigration agents arrested thousands of people over 2 months.
My name is Jocelyn.
Since then, Operation Midway Blitz wound down, and Operation Metro Surge wound up in the Twin Cities.
That's fine, dude. I'm not mad at you.
A source at the Department of Homeland Security told the Chicago Sun-Times that federal agents could return to Chicago in the spring. So far, it's unclear if there will be another surge, but immigration enforcement continues in Chicago. So it's with that context in mind that we took our listener question to some professors of law and history. What exactly does martial law mean?
Martial law is hard to define.
This is Allison LaCroix, constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago.
It's not specifically defined in federal law. The basic idea is you have some sort of emergency situation and military forces take over law enforcement.
In essence, martial law is really turning off the law.
That's Paul Gowder, law professor at Northwestern University.
And saying instead of following the law, we're going to follow the ordinary rules and routines of military conflict.
During martial law, military law replaces civilian law. So instead of your local police department and your local court system, think federal soldiers and military tribunals. These professors told me that martial law is not explicitly defined in the Constitution because we don't really want to have specific circumstances set aside that dictate when a mayor or a governor or a president could declare it. And Professor Gowder goes even further. He says the founders didn't include martial law in the Constitution because they didn't want it to be lawful for anyone to declare at all.
And so in the U.S., that's only really happened a small handful of times when there has been active warfare.
Yes, we have had martial law in America. For one, during the Civil War, when President Abraham Lincoln issued an executive order declaring martial law in some occupied territories in the South. It was in the aftermath of Abe's declaration that we finally get some guardrails, when the Supreme Court limited the scope of martial law. Here's what happened. An Indiana man named Lambdin Milligan gets caught supplying weapons to the Confederacy. He's tried in a military court, and the military court sentences him to death.
So he challenges this, and the Supreme Court says the civilian courts are open in Indiana, and he's a civilian. So even though the Civil War, the literal Civil War, is going on, he can't be dragged into a military court, which doesn't have all the usual protections. His constitutional rights still apply.
The court unanimously rules in favor of Milligan. He's released. His death sentence is thrown out, and he lives for 33 more years. And in that ruling, the court goes on to explain the dangers of martial law, writing that if a military commander has the power to suspend civil rights during a time of war, well then, our system of government is actually a failure.
They go on and they say, martial law established on such a basis destroys every guarantee of the Constitution. And then they invoke the King of Great Britain who did this to our fathers in the American Revolution. So George III, King of England, sends troops to the colonies and has them basically policing the civilian population. That was one of the instigating reasons for the American Revolution. So this mixing of the military and the civil authorities is antithetical to our whole system of government.
Okay. So we know that the Supreme Court says martial law can never exist when civilian courts are operating as usual. And that's because the Founding Fathers were very much not into the idea of mixing civilian and military authorities. And that's why both Professor LaCroix and Gowder think that what we've seen in Chicago and Minneapolis is not martial law.
What's happening right now with ICE and the Border Patrol is that federal law enforcement are, I would argue, and many other people would argue as well, abusively and illegally using their authority and using military-style tactics, but they're still recognizably civilian law enforcement, right? They're not under the military chain of command. They're accountable to regular courts.
That's key, Gowder says. In situations we often consider martial law, the courts are not operating as normal. And regular law enforcement is often overwhelmed. It can't cope with whatever emergency is happening. He says these days, that's not the case. But what about the people who are not getting their day in court, or who are not getting due process before they get moved to remote detention facilities, or in many cases, deported?
That's abusive, but it's abusive in a way that still operates the civilian legal system. It just operates screwed up loopholes that unfortunately we've permitted the federal government to have rather than closing like we should have many years ago.
Historian Tad Stormer offers another way to look at it.
I think functionally it's martial law. I mean, that whether it's legal martial law is for somebody else to decide, but what we're seeing is that this is a surgical approach. And if they can surgically deploy a kind of martial law, a kind of martial authority over civilian jurisdiction, that's exactly what's going on.
Stormer is a professor at Johns Hopkins University and the author of a forthcoming book, A Resistance History of the United States. He says that our question may be better posed to the people who are getting detained by ICE.
I think that they would answer it in strikingly, shatteringly different ways. That they, in fact, are not having access to the same kind of rights and protections, and even habeas corpus is being suspended for them. They will get put on a plane and sent to Louisiana overnight. That is hardly the civilian courts working as designed.
There is, of course, another complicating factor, one we saw when President Trump sent National Guard troops to Chicago.
This morning, the Texas National Guard are on duty in the Chicago area, marking their first mission since arriving in Illinois earlier this week.
When you think martial law, you probably think actual military troops. President Trump actually did send the National Guard to Chicago against the wishes of state and local officials, and for a variety of reasons.
Weeks ago, when President Trump first started talking about sending the Guard to Chicago, the focus was on crime. Then in recent days, it appeared the mission would be to support and protect ICE during Operation Midway.
The Supreme Court stopped this specific deployment because they said the president failed to explain how the situation in Illinois warranted an exception to a very old law. And stick with me, because there are actually a few different laws in play here.
There's this other statute called the Posse Comitatus Act from 1878, where Congress says you can't use any federal troops, National Guard or regular U.S. Army or whoever, to carry out civilian law enforcement. Like, we have police, and the police do that.
So that means even if they were allowed in, it's illegal for the National Guard to act like a police force. Now, they can act like a police force if the president invokes an exception to that law, the Insurrection Act.
Which he has not yet done, although the president's threatened to do this. The Insurrection Act is an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act. So the president can say, there's an insurrection. Now these military troops can enforce the law. They can act more like police.
There are criteria that must be met for that exception to be invoked, but it's all a little fuzzy. The easiest way for troops to come in, and you may already know this, is for a state or local government to ask for it.
It's what in constitutional law sometimes we call the who decides question. Like, what is the situation on the ground and who decides when the emergency is triggered? And so if all the power is in the hands of the president, that is what the founders thought was a recipe for tyranny and despotism. They wanted federalism because they wanted to have different levels of government that would check each other.
Clearly, we're in a land of hypotheticals here. Whether or not invoking the Insurrection Act is constitutional depends on the specific situation, and again, would have to be decided by the courts. So, in the end, whether or not the federal government's actions on immigration are considered martial law, does it even matter?
Yeah, I just wanted to reemphasize that saying this isn't martial law isn't a defense of it. What we're seeing in so-called immigration enforcement right now are an extraordinary and appallingly unconstitutional set of abuses. I think we're seeing routine violations of the Fourth Amendment in terms of illegally searching people, in terms of illegally breaking into homes without a warrant. I think we're seeing a ton of violations of the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment in terms of subjecting people to deportation without adequate hearing. I think we're seeing a ton of illegal race discrimination in the use of profiling to single out particularly Latinos for immigration so-called enforcement, and none of this is okay. You know, all I'm saying is that it doesn't constitute martial law as we ordinarily use the term.
In the instances in which America has definitely experienced martial law, it's almost always been during extremely harrowing times, including the Civil War and the American Revolution. And another example was in Chicago.
1871, Chicago burns, and there's not a single person on the planet that doesn't consider that a major emergency.
Coming up, we look at an example of martial law right here at home.
Did the citizens of Chicago at first like that they were under martial law? Most of them did, yeah. They came not to like it.
That's after the break.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering a roster of public events under the theme No One Can Afford to Lose Love. All are welcome to readings by exceptional Chicago poets, like National Book Award winner Patricia Smith and Chicago Poet Laureate Maida Del Valle, a live musical performance by Decomposed, and more. Details at poetryfoundation.org.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Okay, so now we know a little bit more about what martial law is and is not. A Curious City listener wanted to know more about a time when it was actually declared in our city. Michael Decker recently read a book called The Burning of the World, The Great Chicago Fire and the War for a City's Soul. He said, while reading, he noticed some interesting parallels between the events after the fire and those of today. So he asked if Curious City could take a closer look at it. We called up the author, Scott W. Berg, to hear the story and to ask, why did Chicago's mayor declare martial law? What did that military occupation actually look like? And why did it end? It turns out that after the fire, the business of declaring martial law had a lot to do with Chicago's business elite.
You can't underestimate how clubby Chicago was. You know, cigars and brandy business can be conducted over cards. And so what happens is, even in the middle of a fire, you've got a lot of people who have a lot of influence and money who want certain things done. So they all come to the mayor and they say, we just had ourselves an emergency and we need to lock this city down, because they're worried about their interests, right? Their financial interests. We have to control the security of the city. Oh, look, we happen to have a famous Union general. And I mean, you know, other than Grant and Sherman, the third most famous Union officer, I should say.
Philip Sheridan was very famous and indeed a Civil War hero. And after the war, he moved to Chicago.
He was not from Chicago, but he chose to live in Chicago, and Chicago just loved him for it. I mean, he was very much a local celebrity. Like, if Sheridan had said, I want to be mayor, like, they probably would have just voted him mayor. I don't know, but it feels like they would have.
But the actual mayor was Roswell B. Mason.
Roswell Mason was very much sort of a all but powerless mayor in many ways, who just was in thick with the business interests. But what is clear is that Roswell Mason was the one who had the power to go to Sheridan and say, hey, we want soldiers in the city.
In his proclamation, issued on October 11th, the mayor does not use the words martial law.
I mean, what he declared was absolutely 100% de facto martial law. He says, I have asked General Sheridan to take care of the city. And so Sheridan just brings in about four different sets of federal troops to the city, and then they just show up.
No documents were signed, no statutes invoked. The troops just came. Around 700 federal troops, all actively under Sheridan's command. And when they march in, a whole bunch of people in Chicago are standing on the streets, applauding them for coming to protect the city from arsonists, from looters, and from general chaos.
The newspapers need to sell newspapers, and you're always going to sell more newspapers by pretending that the city is devolving into chaos. It wasn't devolving into chaos. It was safe, quiet, and harmonious, because people just, what were you going to go do in the burned district? Everything was burned.
Sheridan actually said as much himself about a week into his federal occupation.
Quote, there has been no case of violence since the disaster of Sunday night and Monday morning. There has not been a single case of arson, hanging, or shooting, not even a case of riot or street fight. I have seen no reason for the circulation of such reports.
So why a big show of force if there was no chaos? Berg says to compel compliance.
Of course, their visibility is part of the point. Everybody needs to see these folks in all their gear, right?
The soldiers did not have much to do outside of walk around the burn district at night, which was burned to the ground. But despite that, Sheridan decides to create an additional volunteer force. It's made up of mostly local students and the unemployed.
Sheridan institutes a city militia, right? And the city militia under his control were sort of very quickly trained, and their job was essentially just to patrol their own neighborhoods. They hand them a bunch of guns and they say, you're on duty tonight. And that leads to problems.
Late one night, 10 days after the fire, a city attorney named Thomas Grosvenor was walking home through the University of Chicago, well south of the burn zone. It was here where he encountered a 20-year-old sophomore who was on patrol for Sheridan's city militia. His name was Theodore Treat, and he told Grosvenor to halt and state the countersign.
That was a word you were given when you left your neighborhood. Talk about, like, half-baked martial law.
Grosvenor was a 37-year-old Civil War veteran and a respected city attorney. He either didn't know the countersign, didn't remember it, or didn't care. He told Treat to go to hell, and he kept walking. So Treat shot him.
And he shoots him through the side, and he dies several hours later, but this is a disaster for the militias and the federal control of the city, because the papers now have something other than supposed chaos to report on. They have the actual shooting of a city attorney by this young kid who had been handed a rifle.
Just like that, public support for Sheridan's military occupation evaporates.
You know, within a couple of days, this falls apart like a house of cards, and the federal soldiers are gone.
Newspapers that once supported it started coming out against it.
There's a universal, almost universal sense that whatever we're trying to do here, like killing a city attorney, shouldn't be part of it.
But Berg says public support for the soldiers themselves was more nuanced.
In no sense of this was the mass of federal soldiers indicted, because it was the aftermath of a gigantic disaster, the likes of which America had never seen before. There just was no playbook for how federal, state, and city officials should interact with each other, what their responsibilities were. There just was no playbook to say, if a city burns down, this is the hierarchy and who gets to do what.
There wasn't an appetite to prosecute Theodore Treat either, Berg says. He was basically a kid, and there was a sense that the structure of the situation led him to firing his weapon. But the business elite weren't done. They wanted the military back in Chicago.
You know, they do go right back to Sheridan and they go right back to Mason and they say, let's let it cool down for a week. And then can you bring your federal soldiers back? Only this time, let's be a little more careful. I just want them protecting my stuff.
Those troops did come back, Berg says. And again, it didn't last long and they still didn't have much to do. But that brings us back today. There are a lot of reasons why the events of 1871 and today are not comparable. But Berg says there are a few parallels. First,
I'm very, very struck by, in both cases, the creation sort of a quasi-paramilitary force. And so I see the unpreparedness of some of the people doing this as a key comparison.
Last month, CNN reported that the many thousands of new ICE agents are receiving less training than almost any other federal agents. DHS pushed back on that analysis, saying new ICE recruits receive 56 days of training. They say that training has been streamlined, but no requirements have been removed. Another parallel involves that question of federalism we talked about earlier, the who decides question.
John Palmer, the governor of Illinois, basically that morning that Grosvenor shot, he sends a letter to Roswell Mason saying, what are you doing? Like, you can't just bring in federal troops. You didn't even talk to me. Like, I'm the governor of the state, and you didn't even talk to me. And so one of the crucial pieces of all this is this didn't just, like, it wasn't just like, bang, guy dead, all of this quasi-martial law falls apart. This was already something that the state was not only questioning, but the state was deriding.
These days, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson have not asked the federal government for help. And the last parallel Berg sees is the public reaction to the shooting of a civilian.
There's a sense of, wait a second. In today's discussions, especially in light of Minneapolis, I mean, that's a very large portion now of the American public, is that sort of like, well, we understand the aims, but you're just doing it all wrong. And in Chicago in 1871, which is a sort of microcosm and a precursor to all this in some ways, you're seeing people just say, well, this is what it's going to be. Forget it.
A big difference between these cases? In 1871, when a civilian was shot and killed, Berg says the public thought the folks responsible for martial law had learned their lesson. Today, after federal immigration agents have fatally shot people in Chicago, in Minneapolis, and Texas, Berg wonders if the public would say the same.
Mr. President, speaking of Minneapolis, what did you learn?
I learned that maybe we can use a little bit of a softer touch, but you still have to be tough. These are criminals. We're dealing with really hard criminals.
Thank you to Justin Bull for reporting this week's story. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you next week.